was 35 Next to the Garage by Nyla, a Glasgow Women's Library intern, volunteer and employee, and also a pretty amazing musician. Only the fellows and scholars are allowed here. The gravel is the place for me. Such thoughts were the work of a moment, but here I was, actually at the door which leads into the library itself. I must have opened it, for instantly there issued, like a guardian angel, barring the way with a flutter of black gown instead of white wings, a deprecating, silvery, kindly gentleman who regretted in a low voice as he waved me back that ladies are only admitted to the library if accompanied by a fellow of the college or furnished with a letter of introduction. That famous library has been cursed by a woman as a matter of complete indifference to a famous library. Venerable and calm, with all its treasures safe locked within its breast, it sleeps complacently and will, so far as I am concerned, so sleep forever. Never will I wake those echoes, never will I ask for that hospitality again, I vowed as I descended the steps in anger. The inevitable sequel to luncheon and dining at Oxbridge seemed, unfortunately, to be a visit to the British Library. If truth is not to be found on the shelves of the British Museum, where I asked myself, picking up a notebook and a pencil, is truth? Swing doors swung open and there one stood under the vast dome, as if one were a thought in the huge bald forehead, which is so splendidly encircled by a band of famous names. One went to the counter, one took a slip of paper, one opened a volume of the catalogue, and the five dots here indicate five separate minutes of stupefaction, wonder and bewilderment. Have you any notion of how many books are written about women in the course of 1 year? Have you any notion how many are written by men? Are you aware that you are perhaps the most discussed animal in the universe?
That was a lovely reading from A Room of One's Own, written by Virginia Woolf and read by Jessica Sechmesoy Urquhart. This is Glasgow Women's Library's Great Wee Listen. I'm Hannah Wright, and this is Jessica, and take a listen to this.
A woman must have money and a room of her own if she is to write and create. Virginia Woolf wrote this in the aforementioned fundamental feminist text. In today's episode, we are going to explore the long historical march of women gaining access to institutions like Glasgow Women's Library, education, the right to learn, create and engage with others in textual and literary communities. Women have been attempting to find rooms of one's own for centuries, and today we will talk about the ingenious manners in which they have, alongside the challenges and constraints that patriarchal societies have brought to this search for space and language. Let's go. Although we could look at medieval and Renaissance women's access to books, textual communities within convents, the fact is that examples are overwhelmingly representative of only the upper ranks of society. Manuscripts are extremely expensive, pre-printing before the printing press of the 1400s, and nunneries being, as Elaine Power notes, places mainly for aristocratic and merchant family women who could afford them and couldn't be occupied by work like poor women if they were unmarried. Instead, to see how women found rooms of one's own and access to textual communities, we must start with the 16th century Reformation and spread of print culture beyond this point. It would take until the late 1800s, early 1900s, for working class women to be fully liberated. But from here on, different women began slowly to achieve better education, access to different library forms, and books alongside communities. Anna, how did the Reformation and the rise of the printer press change things for women?
Interesting that you ask. Now, for people like me who perhaps didn't take history, I just want to go back to the Reformation and when that actually took place. So the Reformation took place in the 16th century, and this refers to the schism in Western Christianity initiated by Martin Luther and continued by John Calvin and the other early Protestant reformers in Europe, which actually is something I didn't know until we did research for this. So while the Reformation saw most convents closed in Protestant areas, it also saw the start of what would allow our library and others to exist due to a gradual, limited impact on literacy. Also, unlike the unique luxury manuscripts of the rich, through print, texts became more accessible to those beyond the richest, although their price still meant liberation did not apply to most working class people. The new technology would influence special libraries for renting, as we'll see, while the public's rise saw women both excluded by the public, yet attempting to enter it via clubs, societies and salons. This new technology we're referring to is the printing press, something that we might take for granted today, but something that revolutionised the distribution of the written word. In the 15th century, Johannes Gutenberg, a goldsmith by profession, developed a movable type-based printing press system that was new to Europe and drastically reduced the cost of printing books and other documents. By the 16th century and the time of the Reformation, printing presses were in operation throughout Western Europe. And in 1998, Leslie Howsam observed in the newsletter for the Society for the History of Authorship, Reading and Publishing, "Women can be identified at every node of the book production cycle and at all periods in history, from the printer's widows operating independently in the craft guilds of early modern Europe to the avid readership of romance novels, not to mention a strong tradition of women's writing." Interestingly, there's a fascinating conference taking place later this year that will be looking at women in print, production, distribution and consumption. The conference aims to review and readdress the contribution made by women to printing and print culture from its origins to the present day. And it's taking place at Winterbourne House and Gardens in Birmingham on Thursday, 13th of September from 9 a.m. to Friday, September the 14th. I didn't say that very well. Thursday the 13th to Friday the 14th. That sounds very interesting. So Luther and Calvin agreed that the wife should stay at home and look after the affairs of the household, but additionally argued that different classes, girls included, should all be educated. This might have meant partial literacy tied to just religious works, but Luther said it should be further reaching for girls. His 1520 Christian Nobility work attacked convents for failing to educate women, saying leaders should provide girls' schools in every city, with gospel being heard in German and Latin, while his 1524 Alderman address advised schools for German girls and boys that trained the former in both home skills and academic subjects like religion, history, languages, literature, music and maths. While most girls would then become housewives, he argued the sufficiently intelligent could undertake important careers like teaching for girls. German reformers followed this thinking, with Johannes Brentz's Württemberg inclusive educational system far beyond anything seen elsewhere for centuries. Ambrosius Mobianus and Philip Melanchthon both disagreed with St. Paul's view of female inferiority in education, with Mobianus, Breslau's pastor in 1525, saying they are capable of advanced academic studies and printing a girl's poem regarding Jesus Christ, declaring he wanted boys who could easy become scholars to see that girls were capable of the same abilities. The girl's poem praises the blessed child and discusses her freedom to love this and learn this, while cherishing that books forever inspire them. Philip Melanchthon commended the beauty of the poem and the Reformation's impact on girls' education. In our time, they are teaching tender girls to love books and the feminine sex to make use of its gifts. They make intellect flow into the arts, beauty into its culture, nor let such learned now be men.
It's very interesting to hear. You wouldn't expect that, but it's quite amazing.
So the examples we've just been referring to are all examples from Germany. Now, how did all of this affect literacy in England and Scotland?
England, as we know, went through the Reformation under Henry VIII, Anglican Reformation. And although it did change and it was influenced by these developments, it was more of an informal, non-institutional way. Henry VIII had Bibles open in parishes for all congregations to read from 1541, and his daughter Elizabeth reinserted this rite for the congregation. England didn't provide Germany or Geneva's formal female education, though. Women did have a right to read Christian works of some form, and consequently, there was some form of literacy.
The period's most owned text was the Bible, with Octavia versions going for 4 shillings in 1641. Duodecimo scriptures went for 2 shillings by 1724. By the 1750s, whole New Testaments could go for just 1 shilling.
Over 60,000 copies of devotional works, like catechisms or sermons, emerged between 1580 and 1640. This cheap access meant that those like John Bunyan and his wife, who were so poor that they didn't have a spoon betwixt them, could still own copies of books like Man's Pathway to Heaven. Cheaper but not as morally sound were the chapbooks, almanacs, broadsides and ballad sheets that went for pennies when new. Reading did require literacy. If a parent was literate during this period, then a child would be more likely to be so. But informal teachers, in the form of neighbours or literate citizens, such as the poor women that the curate of Cunningham mentioned, could provide tutoring to. David Cressy has highlighted this, among other factors, as leading to English female literacy going from just 5% in the 15th century to 40 or 50% during the 1640s to 1720s. These levels remained uneasy though due to a lack of formal teaching, but culture was changing to warrant this skill. Influences included the Reformation and Puritanism, the rise of accessible literature, an increase in the English vernacular, so the native language, and the expectation of educated female servants and bourgeoisie women dealing with money. Interior spaces were increasingly illiterate, with Louis Schlenner noting that Tudor and Stuart women-in-waiting and servants were called upon more to read to ladies. In Puritan houses, it was doubly important, with mistresses required to teach servants to read and write for the household's spiritual health. A passion for literature can be seen developing during this period among different women, but for the lower class women, it was seen as idle and a negative habit. Elizabeth Cary and her daughter-in-law, Lettice, both loved reading in bed. However, the former was gentry who married into the aristocracy, so this passion was attacked by her mother and mother-in-law. The latter locked her away to keep her away from her books. She rebelled by reading immoral, imaginative works and by teaching herself multiple languages. She published many times following this. Elizabeth Baker, an Oatham yeoman's wife in 1607, was recorded reading at night by her maid. This comfortable literary room, though, within the house or bed, was destroyed by the working class Faversham man Bartholomew Dan, who assaulted his wife when he caught her reading. The reading material allowed for women had been debated ever since Leonardo Bruni's 1400 letter, where he declared geometry down to rhetoric would exhaust a woman who would never see the forum anyway. Women worthies and exemplary girls from Elizabeth I to Margaret Moore or the Cook sisters in England were encouraged to read widely because of their status and rank. This wasn't the same for other girls though. Vives argued girls should only read vernacular religious works since Latin would allow them to read the horrible erotic works by Ovid and Lucian. A century later, 1652, Ralph Verney told his goddaughter Nancy Denton she shouldn't be covetous, but as a woman concern herself only with a Bible and a plain catechism in her mother tongue. Concern for reading habits can also be glimpsed in Touchstone's 1574 comments that Linden maids were supposedly reading amorous books, vain stories, and fond trifling fancies. William Hales' 1609 declaration even said that novels would make girls holy gospelers as wives. These ideals of godly choices read by virtuous girls could be ignored though, which we see in those Liz Carey and what she read, or Lucy Hutchinson, who in the 1600s knew Latin, Greek, Hebrew, thanks to her father's lessons, and knew it was no sin to learn or hear writ songs in amorous sonnets or poems. She even translated Lucretius while embroidering. William Shakespeare was a particularly popular author amongst these women. John Johnson's Academy of Love in 1641 captured it via quite a funny image of Shakespeare creeping into the woman's closet about bedtime, and without any stern granddames to stop him, this would lead young sparkish girls to read Shakespeare day and night. As early as 1635, a young gentle lady was noted as a reader of him. Another woman talked of her study of Shakespeare and the history of women. Well, in 1664, the magnificent Margaret Cavendish wrote one of the first essays ever on him. The
Despite Pauline rejection of female preaching or publishing, 50 women wrote 85 compositions between 1524 to 1640, 36 religious works, 16 religious translations, 30 non-religious compositions, and 3 secular translations. Vulgar or virtuous literature continued to appeal even into the 1700s. On the 8th of September 1713, The Guardian, seeing bourgeois women's newfound spare time, discussed how they had a century life, which allowed them to read while others worked. 1714's Female Spectator saw Heywood write an article where she discussed the pleasures which some sort of books are capable of affording, while Sarah Fielding's Cynthia declared her love of reading and attaining knowledge. Once women could read, they gained irreversible freedom. So I'm wondering, when did libraries kind of come from kind of interior closed spaces and start to impact women? When did women start to have access to forms of libraries before the public library?
Well, while in the 1700s to the 1800s, books were nowhere near as pricey as the past manuscripts of the rich elites, this didn't mean that all books outside religious works were accessible to all women. Although Yvonne Forsling notes 15,000 English titles being published in the 1700s, with the last three decades having a 400% publishing increase, the average three-volume novel cost a guinea in 1815. Using the modern worth of golden guineas, that would be around £100 today.
Wow.
This was beyond poor women and often middle-class women's reach. From the Renaissance onwards, however, new communal book collections within libraries were developing, turning them from closed institutions due to the cost of the material to lending open institutions. Examples range from Bristol Calendar's library, which was established in 1464 and which was publicly accessible, collegiate and town libraries like Dundee Borough Library, established in the 1400s, Norwich City, established in 1608, East Lothian's 1658 parochial Calvinist public library, and the Bodleian Library, established in 1602, and Chetham's Library, Manchester, established in 1653. The latter claims to be the oldest English-speaking public library. Like the college library, which Wolfe discussed, these were almost all off-limits to women.
Quite masculine spaces.
Mm. Two interconnected library types developed, which weren't off-limits, and widened access to more books. Subscription and circulating libraries. They pool the demands of many for books that few could afford independently. The former collections matched their subscribers' wishes, be they scientists, religious laity, or later, suffragettes. They involved fees or shares, but were more literary resources for different groups and were often found in rural areas as they weren't profit-dependent. Circulating libraries were about profit. By 1800, there were 200 in England, and despite public libraries, they would continue to impact fiction's market until the 20th century. Publishers and businessmen ran them, with popular texts prospering, and they were mostly present in cities and big towns where there were enough customers to make a profit. The first true circulating library was Alan Ramsay's Edinburgh shop, which opened in 1725 and incurred the wrath of Reverend Robert Wodrow, who attacked its villainous, profane and obscene books and plays printed in London, which were lent to young boys, servant women of the better sort and gentlemen. Women and others were being corrupted by access to unsavoury books from London, he believed. Despite this, more like James Leake's 1728 Bath version appeared, then it became a cultural phenomenon. Thomas Wright's London Library opened in the 1730s, and by the 1750s, London had 9 operating, which grew to 26 by 1800 to the 1820s due to franchises. William Batho's, Thomas Lowndes, and John and Francis Noble's had large stocks of 5,000 titles. John Bell in 1778 and Thomas Hookham in 1764 both had stock of 8,000 texts. William Lane's Minerva Press and Library was the largest, with the 1796 to 1802 records documenting 20,000 titles. His 1740 to 1840 impact was massive, as he offered ready-made stock and advertising via franchising provincial libraries. Outside London and Spa Town Bath, development was slower. Newcastle and Birmingham had 4,619 titles, while Newton Abbey had 430. Only 31 circulating libraries were in 1801 Scotland, 7 in Edinburgh and 5 in Glasgow. Annual fees between 1730 and 1842 were on average double a three-volume novel, rising to 2 guineas between 1750 to 1814, though some publishers undercut prices to get business.
It's quite interesting that, again, the place that it was Scotland that came up with them first, and yeah, they had the least when it came to later on in the period, the influence, but they didn't really represent it much later. And how expensive that this was,
mm-hmm.
even so for the working class, it was still restricted.